This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Joseph Zechevich. Baltimore is the second largest export port for coal, including West Virginian coal, but a bridge collapse in the harbor could put transportation in jeopardy.
Proximity to the Northern Appalachian coal basin might have been attractive from a transportation cost standpoint, but putting all your eggs in one basket.
That story and more coming up this West Virginia Morning. Support for West Virginia Morning is proudly provided by Luke Frazier. A U.S. District Court judge granted and dismissed some sanctions that plaintiffs requested against the West Virginia Department of Human Services over missing emails. Earlier this year, attorneys with A Better Childhood presented evidence that they believed showed the department purposely deleted emails related to a class action lawsuit. The DHHR said the Office of Technology was responsible for the statewide policy of deleting the emails of people who left the state's employment within 30 days. The judge in the case said the deletion of emails was not intentional, but a miscommunication between departments. However, the judge ordered the Department of Human Services to pay the plaintiff's attorney fees acquired during the request for sanctions. In a press release, the Department of Human Services said it is pleased with the judge's sanction decision, but does not agree with all the conclusions in the magistrate judge's decision. The closure of the Port of Baltimore to most shipping has a ripple effect for coal producers in northern West Virginia. Curtis Tate takes a deeper look.
The Port of Baltimore exported 28 million tons of coal last year, about half of it from West Virginia. After a container ship struck the Francis Scott Key Highway Bridge last week, collapsing the structure, Baltimore Harbor's coal piers have been cut off from the rest of the world. For now, the companies that produce the coal will have to find a way to other ports, mainly Norfolk or the Gulf Coast. If not, customers in India, China, Japan, and South Korea, among others, may have to turn to alternative sources. John Saldana, a professor of global supply chain management at West Virginia University, said Baltimore is the second largest U.S. export port for coal behind Norfolk, accounting for about a fifth of U.S. coal exports. He said even if Norfolk and other ports have the capacity to absorb coal shipments that would otherwise come through Baltimore, it will raise shipping costs. That includes more train crews, more rail cars and locomotives, and more space to store the coal on the ground at another port.
In the short run, immediately, clearly there's going to be an increase in transportation costs. And depending upon what capacity the rail carriers can find and how much diversion capacity the rail carriers find, both on their transportation networks as well as at the ocean piers, that is going to tell whether the coal producers will actually have to throttle back on their production in the short run. Because if they continue producing at current rates and there is no way to load that coal onto rail cars and for those rail cars to go to the port and there is no capacity at the port, then clearly that will require the coal producers to throttle back on production.
Saldana said in ordinary times, Northern Appalachian coal from West Virginia and Pennsylvania is closer to the Port of Baltimore. Now that that's been disrupted, even temporarily, producers may take a look at whether they need to consider an alternative.
Given that Baltimore and its proximity to the Northern Appalachian coal basin might have been attractive from a transportation cost standpoint, but putting all your eggs in one basket, shipping everything out through the Port of Baltimore, of course, such black swan events nobody can anticipate, but then you always want to hedge. And if you have all of your eggs in one basket and you're exporting everything through one single export port, then if anything happens either to the transportation links to that port, within the port, or coming out of that port, that is going to disable your operation, at least hobble your operation in the short run.
Also ordinarily, mid-Atlantic ports are closer to markets in Asia through the Suez Canal. But recent turmoil in the Middle East has caused the diversion of ocean-going vessels around the Cape of Good Hope at the southern tip of Africa. Saldana said that gives Gulf Coast ports an advantage.
So normally, coming from Port of Baltimore, it would have been a lot more easier to go into the Suez Canal. But now, because of the Red Sea and the Houthi rebels affecting shipping over there, all the ships, so going down from the Gulf of Mexico, to the Cape, that might actually even be a little bit more competitive compared to coming out of the East Coast, given that all the several shipping companies are opting to route their ships around the Cape.
Even if Asian customers may need to consider sourcing coal from elsewhere, Australia, for example, Saldana said they still prefer Northern Appalachian coal because of its quality.
So I think in the long run, the Northern Appalachian Basin coal provides a superior product to the other coal sources. But in the short run, there are definitely substitutes that are available that, while not of the same quality, you would definitely fill the need.
Federal, state, and local officials have said their first priority is to reopen the Port of Baltimore. But they will have to remove all the pieces of the fallen bridge from the water, and that's not a small task. Saldana said the port may not reopen for weeks, if not months. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
It is 7:49. You're listening to West Virginia Morning. One solution to slow climate change is for industrial facilities to capture carbon dioxide emissions before they reach the atmosphere. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant looked into a new project that would transport that CO2 to underground storage wells, including in Pennsylvania.
Landmen are knocking on doors again, but this time it's not for oil and gas development. It's to lease land for wells to store carbon underground. The Nebraska-based company Tenaska is developing a project in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Ohio that it calls the Tri-State CCS Hub.
My name is Brett Eastep. I'm the Vice President of Development for Tenaska, and I lead our carbon capture and sequestration initiative.
Eastep explains that their potential customers would be fossil fuel heavy industrial facilities like gas power plants and steel manufacturers interested in reducing their carbon dioxide emissions. There are tax incentives in the Inflation Reduction Act for each ton of carbon a facility captures and stores. It's part of the federal plan to deal with the climate crisis. Eastep says its customers will capture their own CO2 emissions, and Tenaska will build the pipelines to transport it to underground storage wells in rural areas.
That's our business model, is that transport and storage piece.
Tenaska and other partners are negotiating for up to $69 million from the Department of Energy for project development. Eastep says Tenaska plans to drill 15 to 20 storage wells where it will inject the CO2. Their target is to store 5 million metric tons annually. Eastep says they've had overwhelming response from companies that want this service. Now they need rights from property owners so they can build injection wells on the surface and store the carbon thousands of feet underground.
So we're in what I would call the sort of mid-stage of development. We're actively negotiating with landowners for pore space rights, so the real estate right deep underground to store the CO2.
I'm going to give you enough information and things to get started.
The Ohio Farm Bureau has held meetings in eastern counties where landowners are being approached for this project.
And probably ask some pressing questions of some of the developers that are coming to your community with regard to this.
Retired Marine and police officer Ed Hashberger attended one of them. He says a few years ago, he would have been excited by a new industry like this.
I'm a diehard Republican, okay?
He and his wife have been raising chickens and enjoying the wildlife at their hilltop home with a view looking across the valley. When an energy company came knocking on his door a few years ago, Hashberger was into it.
Because drill, baby, drill. You know, we have resources here. Let's take advantage of it.
But the Hashbergers also wanted to protect the air, land, and water. So they teamed up with neighbors to get environmental protections in their gas leases. But as this whole new CO2 industry moves in, Hashberger has concerns.
You're actually going to put this stuff in the ground. What could happen if we have an accident? What can we do to mitigate these situations as they arise?
He worries about an accident like the one in rural Mississippi in 2020 when a carbon dioxide pipeline ruptured. At least 45 people were hospitalized. Many were unable to breathe. Some lay on the ground unconscious, and cars wouldn't work, so it hampered emergency response. Hashberger looks down from his home to the houses that sit along the creek.
What about the small subdivisions of the communities that are around these injection wells? God forbid that one of them burp up and release that gas and settle down there.
Neeraj Gupta is a researcher at Battelle, an independent nonprofit institute in Columbus. He's been looking into carbon capture and storage for two decades.
That's the biggest objective, is make sure that it does not leak out.
He says the carbon dioxide is compressed and then injected into porous underground rock layers, capped by a layer of impervious rock-like shale to prevent leakage.
That's why we do go through very detailed characterization, seismic surveys, well testing, reservoir modeling.
Gupta explains that drillers have been safely injecting CO2 into underground rock for 50 years in a process called enhanced oil recovery. But injecting carbon into rocks and keeping it there permanently, essentially forever, is a newer idea. Gupta points to a project in Illinois that's been in operation since 2015 and one in Norway as evidence that carbon storage works.
I think we have shown that, yeah, it can be done, it can be monitored, and that pilot test work, experimental work, has been used by EPA to develop the current regulations.
In most states, it's the EPA that issues permits for CO2 injection wells. Currently, it has only 8 permits in the whole country. But the tax incentives are driving new interest, and the agency is considering 127 new wells. Still, that's just a drop in the bucket of how much storage would be needed to make a dent in U.S. carbon emissions. So far, there are no permit applications in the tri-state region targeted by Tenasca, but the company says it will submit plans to the EPA in the next month or two for wells in Hancock County, West Virginia.
So the question is, how good are these plans at making sure that the carbon that's pushed underground is contained?
Eric Schaefer is executive director of the nonprofit Environmental Integrity Project, which looked into EPA's permitting process. He says the permit application asks how the company will assure the carbon stays underground and how often it will monitor the wells.
It turns out there's no wrong answer to the question. It's kind of whatever the industry says.
He's concerned that once the storage capacity is full at a site, companies will just walk away.
One of the disturbing things we saw is you finish up the project and within some cases 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, you stop monitoring. You're pretty much, you know, lock the door and leave.
Schaefer says if the carbon seeps out into the atmosphere, it not only presents possible dangers, it also defeats the purpose of spending all that public money to slow down climate change. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website at wppublic.org. Support for our news bureau comes from Shepherd University. West Virginia Morning is produced with help from Bill Lynch, Brianna Heaney, Chris Schultz, Curtis Tate, Emily Rice, Eric Douglas, Jack Walker, Liz McCormick, and Randy Yowie. Emily Rice produced today's episode. I'm Joseph Zechevich. It is currently 7:58. Stay tuned for more Morning Edition and news coming up next.